In 1851, an English missionary named Alan Gardner was shipwrecked with some others on a remote, uninhabited island right at the, sort of the southernmost tip of South America. And all those who were shipwrecked died one by one, and Gardner was the last of them to die. They were never rescued, but they found his dead body, and his journal lay right beside him where he was died of starvation. And looking at his journal, the last entry in his journal was a quote. He wrote out a quote from reference from Psalm 34:10, which says this: "The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing." And the very last thing he wrote, along with Psalm 34:10 in his journal before he died, is, "I am overwhelmed with the sense of the goodness of God." Wow. Right? He's dying of starvation, without hope, left all alone. Everyone around him has died. And his prayers for rescue unanswered. And he says, "God is so, so good. I've experienced his goodness. I am overwhelmed with his goodness." His final thoughts, recorded thoughts, go to the overwhelming goodness of God, even in the midst of his suffering and loss. When is it that you and I say, "God is good to me. God's been really good to me"? I had a guy, went out for lunch, and he bought me lunch. This is when I was in Portland. He bought me lunch because he said, God's been really good to my business. And it's true, I'm really appreciative of the man's generosity. He bought me lunch. But we often speak of God's goodness coming to us through our experiences and usually related to material things, right? When our circumstances are good, we say, "God's been good to me. The money's coming in, relationships are enjoyable and positive, work is successful, we have health, you know, things are going well physically for us." So we tend to conclude that God has been good based on our observations about our circumstances. We think about the situations we're in and evaluate God's goodness based on that. But Alan Gardner knew that God was good through his direct experience with God's goodness and in spite of his circumstances, right? And it's really, really profound. And so how can we rejoice in the goodness of God in the midst of suffering and loss when our circumstances fall apart? And today, Habakkuk is showing us the way. Because Habakkuk is going to experience the loss of all things, not unlike Alan Gardner. And both Alan Gardner and Habakkuk are pointing us to something incredibly profound, that we can have peace and joy and experience the goodness of God, even if our circumstances entirely give way. And so here, quick review, for in case you haven't been with us or you've forgotten too much sunshine, you've lost your any recollection of Habakkuk 1 and 2. Habakkuk 1, week 1, we said, Habakkuk laments to God about the evil in Judah, right? And God responds by saying, "Yes, and I see that, and the wicked Babylonians are coming to judge." And Habakkuk laments. And we learn that it's good to lament, that it's good. It's God's gift to us. It's the pathway of honest wrestling in prayer with God. Because there's two typical responses to God in suffering. There's the sort of the religious traditional response, which is to bottle it up. You're not supposed to have feelings of lament and sorrow and pain and loss, so you just put on a brave face, trust in God, and just don't deal with it. And that's sort of the traditional religious response. You don't deal with it. You bottle it up. And then there's the opposite response, which is more common, sort of the modern, somewhat arrogant response, which is, "I can see my circumstances, and I can judge that God can bring nothing good from this. Therefore, he's wrong, or I just reject him." And so it acts as judge and jury of God and goes, "Well, this is not good, and I know best, so I'm just angry with God, or I reject God, or God can't exist," or something like that. So you either bottle it up, or you just turn on God completely. But Habakkuk doesn't do either of those things. And which is so remarkable, because these are the two paths we usually take. Habakkuk shows us a third way, the pathway of honest wrestling. So he shows us lament, the pathway of honest wrestling. And then week two, Habakkuk laments some more, because God's answer wasn't very satisfying. there's injustice in Judah. God says, yes, so I will send the wicked Babylonians to judge them. And they're like, the wicked Babylonians. So he's got more lamenting to do. But he also chooses to wait on the Lord. He chooses to seek God in his pain and suffering and his confusion. And he seeks to watch for God's response and to pray some more to God. And God responds by calling Habakkuk to live by faith. And he shows him that ultimately the Babylonians, they too will be judged. He has a sovereign plan. Just walk by faith. And so we saw that we need to seek God in our trouble. And so we put ourselves in the community of God's people. We pray, we open God's word, because these are not times to turn on God. That's this view. These are not times to bottle it up. That's this view. But it's time to run to God all the more, to hear him out, to seek him, be surrounded by the means of grace and the people of God. And the second thing we learned from last week was we need to trust God. Trust his sovereign plan, even when it makes no sense to us, because he has a sovereign plan. It may not add up, but we trust him anyway. The righteous walk by faith. Someone shared a really nice insight with me after last week's sermon. It was like, where were you 2 hours ago? But the shortcut answer, the bottle it up way in loss, it is what we do is we go, okay, you don't feel feelings of sorrow, just trust, right? Here, Romans 8:28, come on, smack that in someone's head. Pat answers, just trust. And ultimately, that answer is kind of right, because that's where Habakkuk gets eventually, doesn't he? Eventually, he gets to a place of, I just need to trust, but he gets there through lament, through wrestling, through processing it. And so the problem with the bottle it up, just trust, is it shortcuts the path that God has given us. And so it's not really a deep, significant, meaningful trust. It's just the facade of trust. And that's the problem with just, quote, Romans 8:28. God works all things together for good. Therefore, don't feel loss and pain. Just, you know, we beat the... So it's the right answer, but the wrong way. Habakkuk needs to lament, he needs to wrestle, he needs to pray, he needs to seek God's face and wait on the Lord, and eventually he needs to come to a place of, I don't have the answers, and I choose to trust, and it's meaningful, significant, deep trust in God's sovereign plan. So often we just want a shortcut and get to just smack someone with Romans 8:28, stop having feelings, and just trust. And it's kind of right, but it's the wrong way. You can't shortcut, because you're just bottling it up, all those feelings of lament that you need to express, that God is calling us to express. And so you end up with a trite and empty appearance of trust, while underneath is still chaos. So we see, number one, lament, honest wrestling. Number two was wait on the Lord, seek God in times of pain and suffering. Number three we see was ultimately you do have to trust the sovereign plan of God, even if it doesn't make sense. And number four is this week where Habakkuk shows us the way of rejoicing, the way of rejoicing. Okay, verse 1, Habakkuk's plea, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet, according to Shigionoth. O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. So the back and forth conversation between Habakkuk and the Lord is over now. And Habakkuk has, you know, he's kept silent before the Lord. That was the end of chapter 2. He's come to a place of acceptance and trust. But now we have a prayer. And this chapter is unique is because there's a number of indications in it that it actually started as Habakkuk's prayer, but then became part of Hebrew worship. Probably became a song that the congregation would sing together, a song for hard days, a song for days of sorrow and loss, that it became incorporated in Hebrew worship. The reason why I say that is we see in three different places this word, this Hebrew word, salah, and these little markings, people aren't really sure exactly what they mean, but they only occur in Habakkuk 3 and the Psalms. There's like 70-something occurrences in the Psalms and here. So there's something similar here that's going on here that only otherwise happens in the Psalms. And so the Babylon Bee, you know the Babylon Bee? It's Christian satire sites. It's not serious, but it's really funny. The Babylon Bee announced that they discovered that salah means guitar solo. So that's where they would like... So you're going along through the song, and then that's where you like break out the guitar solo. But what it actually seems to be is that the salah marks some sort of musical change, or in this case, it seems to mark the beginning of a new stanza. It's actually that there's the title of the stanza, and then the salah marking, and then the rest of the stanza. And then you get the title of the next stanza, the salah marking, and then. So it's marking how the text lays out. The final words of the whole chapter are to the choir master with stringed instruments. So that actually leads well into the guitar solo interpretation. There's stringed instruments anyway. So it's meant to be played with string instruments. And then this weird word, shigionoth, it's not actually a person. It only occurs one other time in the Psalms. And it seems actually to be like the musical tune or the meter or something related. It's like a marking to tell you how to play the song and how to sing it. So it's probably like the tune that the words are set to. So we've got kind of markings for where the stanzas, the verses are. We know it's with stringed instruments. It was given to the choir master or dedicated to the choir master. And you're supposed to do this in the style of shigionoth. So it's a song. It's a song. And for those who are like really into ancient Hebrew song structure, here's how it probably went. It probably went like verse one's the title. You don't sing that. Verse two is like the refrain or the chorus. And it'll probably get repeated throughout. And then you've got verse 3 to verse 8 is the first stanza or verse, right? And so you got the title is verse of that stanza is in verse 3, and then the salah, and then you've got the rest of the stanza goes to verse 8. So the second stanza then runs from verse 9 to verse 13. So you sing that, and then you're back to the refrain. And then verse 13 to 15 is the third stanza. And then verse 16 to 19, things change. The whole poetry changes, the topic changes. So it's like the bridge where, you know, you change musically, you introduce a new theme, and you bring it kind of to a close. So that's probably how it worked. And we'll sing it now. No, just kidding. So what we have is the prayer of Habakkuk in light of his conversations with God, and it becomes the prayer of God's people. And so we know that Habakkuk experienced, it's not just for him, it's for all of God's people, that they need to follow Habakkuk in his lament and in this pathway. And so that's what we want to try and do. So Habakkuk, it starts with, he's heard a report of God's work in verse 2. And some translations, instead of work, say fame. It's what God's done and what he's known for. And so Habakkuk knows what God has done. And I think it's actually talking not about the current situation, but what God has done in the past. He knows God's what he's famous for. He knows what God's work has been. He knows what God's been up to over the years. He's heard of God's mighty deeds and fame. And in this song, Habakkuk is going to poetically remember God's mighty acts and retell them in sort of a poetic way, especially focusing on the Exodus and the entrance into the land of Canaan. You watch, and there's lots of Exodus imagery scattered throughout. And at the end of verse 2, though, he prays, and he makes his plea, and he asks for three things. And he's come to accept that God's judgment is coming, but in light of that, he asks for three things. And the first one is to revive your work. It's verse 2. His prayer is that God's word and his work and his worship would be revived, just as it was in the days of King Josiah when Habakkuk was younger. He wants revival to come again. So he prays for revival, prays that God's judgment wouldn't be the end of his people. But yes, God's judgment is coming, but that there would be revival afterwards, that there would burst forth new life. Secondly, he prays to make known your work, to show your work to us. Show us what you're doing. We want to see you. We want to see what you're up to. And the third thing he prays for is that in wrath, remember mercy. Habakkuk has come to understand and accept the importance and necessity of God's divine holy wrath. Right? There's wickedness, there's injustice, there's violence, there's disobedience in Judah, and it cannot be accepted. Habakkuk's living through evil days, and God can't just give a stamp of approval on it. God needs to intervene, and God's wrath is holy and just and right, and God's wrath is to set things right, and so it's good. But Habakkuk prays that in his wrath, he would also remember mercy. He accepts wrath, but what they need is mercy, because They need God to be merciful to them. Without mercy, the righteous wrath of God would just destroy them all for their sin. And that would be right. It would be righteous. And yet, none would survive. And so, they don't deserve to stand, but they need God's mercy. So, yes, God, you've said you're coming in your wrath, but please also be merciful. And in his mercy, God will preserve a remnant. God will save many by grace. And so they're praying for God's mercy in the midst of his wrath. And then verse 3 to verse 15 is like the three stanzas, and it's this big vision of God coming as this like divine mighty warrior that's going to fight for the salvation of his people and fight against the nations that oppress them. So it's this poetic visionary song about God the warrior who has rescued them in the past. And remembering that and picturing that, okay? So here it is again. It's pretty awesome. So watch for the divine warrior, God as mighty warrior imagery. It's very symbolic and significant. And watch for the all the Exodus language, like the things that you'd expect around when God rescued them out of Exodus. Okay, here's verse 3. God came from Tamam and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand. There he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Kishon in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers or your indignation against the sea when you rode on your horses and on your chariot of salvation? You stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their place. At the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear, you marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. Wow, cool. So the language shifts here from Habakkuk's prayer to now a description of what he sees, this visionary experience picturing God as this mighty warrior. It's this theophanic vision of God. I say that because it's one of my favorite words, theophanic. It's like a theophany, a vision of God, right? So God is this theophanic warrior. It's just a cool word. You can use it later. Theophanic. It's a theophany, a vision of God coming as this glorious, mighty warrior. He's got a spear, he's got arrows, and he's coming to kick butt and take names and conquer. And what he does is he comes from Tamam, which is technically it's Edom, but it's also the word comes to mean the south. So he's coming from the south, and Paran is the ancient name for the Sinai wilderness. So he's coming up from Egypt. He's coming up from the south. And so this is the first hint that we're replaying the Exodus story because God is coming out of Egypt up into Israel. And this whole section is packed with Exodus imagery. God is coming in power and he's bringing plagues and pestilence and he's shaking the nations. He's marching through the earth. He's bringing salvation to his people. And he says in verse 6 that he scatters the eternal mountains and everlasting hills. It's not that God doesn't like mountains. He does. Think, but that these are the places where the ancient neighbors of Israel worship their gods, right? It's up on the top of the mountains that they have their sacrifices and altars and they're worshiping. Those are the places of worship of all the pagan gods. So when God comes and shakes the mountains and scatters them, he's destroying the other gods and the worship of them. That's what he's doing symbolically, destroying, defeating the Canaanite gods. And their evil worship practices, like sacrificing babies and doing all these things that they're doing. And then in verse 7, as he's passing the nations in the regions of the south, like the Midianites, he's terrifying them. He's marching north to deal with Babylon. That's what he's doing. And everyone's terrified because he's like this mighty warrior God, glory, power, and lightning, and shaking, and like, it's kind of Exodus 20, like when Israel comes to Mount Sinai, and the whole mountain's like shaking, and people are like, okay, we're going to die, because this is so overwhelming in power, and God speaks, and they tell Moses, don't let that happen again, because we cannot handle and endure the voice of God. It's a similar thing here, but he's on the move now. He's the divine warrior on the move. And in verse 9, we get all this archery image that he's coming as like this warrior archer ready for battle. And verse 9 to 12 describes this cosmic battle where the Lord overcomes the powers of darkness and all creation stands in fear, and he comes in victory and salvation. And there's a lot of imagery about the ocean and waters, because often in the Hebrew worldview, the seas and the oceans are where evil dwells, right? It's the place, because there's, you don't know what's under there, right? And so it's the place of evil beasts, and like in Revelation, the beast comes out of the sea, and it's the place of chaos and evil. And I mean, I love the ocean, but the ancient Hebrews, I guess, didn't, because they saw it as the place of chaos and evil. But the waters are all afraid of God in the image, and he like conquers them and stuff like that. It's really about him conquering evil. And he's the divine warrior that's coming. And in the final stanza, verse like 13, he crushes the head of the wicked one, which is sort of a double meaning. Like, in a sense, it means that Yahweh will crush Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar will not stand. He's the king of the Babylonians that's coming to oppress them. But in another sense, have you heard anywhere else where God will crush the head of something? Like, it kind of goes back to Genesis 3:15. And that the seed of the woman will crush the seed of the serpent. So in a way, this is about Nebuchadnezzar. And in a way, it's about God overcoming evil. So he's going to crush the head of the wicked and defeat Nebuchadnezzar. And he's overcoming the wicked leader and all his warriors and everyone on his team. And so in this big, cool, overwhelming, weird, awesome vision, it's kind of like Ezekiel in some ways, in this big vision of God, we see him as the divine warrior. He's coming to rescue his people and bring his wrath against the wicked nations and that have oppressed them. And so what we see is that while God will use the Babylonians to judge his people, right? God can take a wicked thing and the evil choices of the Babylonians, he can pick it up and he can shape it and use it for his purposes and put it back down and his hands don't get dirty. He will also come himself as a warrior, and he will rescue his people, and he will judge the Babylonians for their wickedness. And the poem is reminding God's people that God in the past has come to fight for his people, and he will in the future as well. That God is a warrior God who comes for the salvation of his people. And so he's reminding them of all the ways that God has come and rescued and brought salvation and victory for them in the past. Think of the plagues of Egypt, he says. Think of crossing the Red Sea into freedom. Think of God's glory at Mount Sinai. Think of his power and provision in the wilderness. Think of crossing into the land of Canaan and God giving you this land and defeating your enemies. Think of his mighty acts through Samuel and through David and through Elijah and Elisha. Remember that God is a warrior God, and he's a commander of armies, and he's a God of unspeakable power and glory and might. Remember who he is. Remember what he's done. Remember all his victories. And so, yes, we're facing a dark day, but remember who God is. And this is a common approach in the Bible. The Bible does this a lot, where it calls us to remember. Remembering is a powerful tool for us on hard days. In hard circumstances, we are to look back and to remember who God is, remember what he's done in the past. Remembering is one of the key tools for walking with God, is looking back and remembering. Remember his might, remember his character, remember his provision, remember his guidance, his blessing, his salvation, his faithfulness. Remember and rehearse who he is, what he's done for us in the past, and therefore know what he will do for you in the present and the future. So in the Bible, they're constantly looking back and rehearsing, especially two things: remembering his promises and how they were fulfilled to Abraham and how they continue or are given to his descendants, and remember his mighty acts, especially his Exodus. So there's Exodus imagery throughout the whole Bible, actually. The Exodus story keeps getting replayed and replayed. And so Habakkuk here is really focusing on remembering that God is the divine warrior that rescued them out of Egypt. And it's replaying the Exodus story. And the reason is that the Exodus story is sort of the gospel of the Old Testament, right? The enslaved people are rescued by God's power and grace, based on nothing of their own doing, entirely of Him. And they are brought into freedom and into relationship with God and set free from everything that oppressed them. The Exodus is the gospel of the Old Testament. And essentially, Habakkuk here is remembering and rehearsing the gospel, telling himself the gospel until he breaks into a place of peace and joy. So he's preaching the gospel to himself. He's reminding himself of who God is, that he's a divine warrior, that he works for the salvation of his people, that he brings to justice those who oppress us. He's retelling the gospel story again and again until he arrives at a place of peace and joy. And so for us, we need to look back and remember. Part of that is we have to look back and remember who God is and what he's done in the Bible. This is a tool for us to remember who God is and who our God is and how he's acted for his people in salvation history. Look back and remember. We also need to look back and remember how God has acted for you through the gospel. The death and resurrection of Jesus in your place. That God is a God who has not left us in our sin and trouble and despair, enslaved to our desires, but he came and he, by the death and resurrection of Jesus, he set us free. He died the death that we deserved. He's given us grace and mercy and kindness and forgiveness and acceptance and welcome into his family. And so we remember what God has done for you personally. And the God that did all that, do you think he'll leave you? Having done what he's done, is he just going to bring you this far and ditch you? No. And part of it is we look back and remember how God has walked with us in our own life. How has he been to you? Has he been faithful to you over the years? Remember and rehearse the acts of God's faithfulness in your own story, in your own journey. We forget these things. We need to remember them. So I do this often. This is called walking the Christian life. I have to look back, faced with difficulty or a painful situation or filled with doubt about can God work in this situation or what will happen? You know, worried, or these thoughts of worry and doubt and fear come into my mind. And what I have to do is rehearse the story. I remember when my job fell apart and I moved my family from Manitoba to BC and then everything collapsed and all of a sudden I had no job. Like this whole situation just blew up in my face and I'm going, what am I going to do? God, you brought us here and it didn't work out, and why am I here? Why'd you lead us here if it's leading nowhere? And then that was how God led us to this church and this community. And you go, oh, so that was a disaster that God brought us through to bring us here. And I remember how God called me to ministry and how clear that was and then provided again and again throughout it. And so when I face hard times in ministry, I go, well, God called me. So I know that I have something certain to hold on to. We remember how God called us to adopt and miraculously provided all the money when it was twice as much as we ever anticipated. We remember how, you know, we lost our third rental home in 5 years and are going, where are we going to live? And then God provided a house again and one that we could live in for a long time. We have to keep remembering these moments of crisis when God came through again and again and again and answered prayers and answered the prayers that we didn't have enough faith to pray and surprised us. And so we rehearse God's goodness to ourselves, remembering that the God that has provided again and again and has been faithful to this point will be faithful again. He will do so again. He will not abandon us. And that's what Habakkuk's doing. God's a divine warrior who kicks butt and saves his people. That's who he is. Let's not forget that when the Babylonians are bearing down on us. And so life may get super hard. You may be filled with pain and loss and suffering and difficulty. Nowhere are we promised that life is easy. But we are told that God is faithful and good, and how he's been good in the past, he will be good in the future, and he will not fail you. So what about for you? What's God's track record? You got to have this stuff at the ready. Look at the Bible. What has God done in salvation history? Look at the cross. Look at the gospel. How has God acted in love and compassion and mercy and grace towards you in the cross? And then look at your own story. Where's God been faithful over the years? Rehearse those things. Tell themselves to you again. Remind yourself again and again. And this is what Habakkuk is doing for his people, is they're remembering that who God is, the divine warrior who's rescued them in the past and will rescue in the future. And then at verse 16, we get to the bridge, right? The bridge is like the change. The musical theme changes, and maybe it changes key or tempo. It changes things up a bit. And here, a new message is introduced, a new take on the whole situation. Verse 16, this is so incredibly powerful. So incredibly. Verse 16. After all this, right, and the coming Babylonian invasion, I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. Right? We see this is not the bottle it up kind of thing, because he's like, his body is trembling. He's like shaking with fear. He's overwhelmed, right? This is not easy. The Babylonians are coming, and his heart is pounding, and he's trembling and shaking. He's afraid. There's fear. Life has fearful things. He can be afraid. But not only fear, right? Not only fear. His fear is very real, very present, but it is eclipsed by something more. And so the final note of the book is not fear, though there is fear. But the final note of the book is joy, not fear. And so he says, though he's overwhelmed with fear in verse 16, the Babylonians are coming. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. Trouble for who? The trouble here is the trouble on the Babylonians, the people who invade us. I'm waiting for that day. I'm going to wait because God will do what he says he's going to do. So I'm going to wait for it. He's going to quietly wait for the day when God will bring the rescue that he promises. And ultimately, he does. It takes many years, but he does. So the Babylonians are coming, but I'm going to resolve to wait quietly for the day of their demise that God has promised, the day of justice. I know that God is a warrior God. I know that God is a big, sovereign God, and he will bring the justice that he has promised, and he will bring the salvation that he has promised. And then verse 17, though destruction is coming, and it will be bad, even through poverty, famine, loss, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. Wow, really, Habakkuk? Really? After all this lamenting and honest wrestling, you're going to rejoice in the Lord? Suppose, you know, Habakkuk says, I'm going to rejoice, and we would say, well, but suppose that the fig trees didn't blossom. There's no more figs to eat, and there's no fruit on the vines. Like, what about then? Then are you going to rejoice if there's no food to eat? Suppose the fields don't yield and there's just famine. There's no food because the crops have been destroyed by the Babylonians. Are you going to rejoice when there's nothing to eat and there's famine? What if the flocks are all gone because they've been stolen or killed? What if there's no herds? You've got barns, but there's no animals in them. In poverty, in famine, are you going to rejoice then? When they're hungry? It's very poetic, but it isn't just poetry. This is the impending disaster that's coming to them when the Babylonians invade. Famine and destruction. This is like Europe after World War II. It wasn't just the loss of life in the fighting. There was no crops. There was no food. There was famine, and a lot of people died in those first years after the war ended because the continent was devastated. And Habakkuk is showing us that even at that level of crisis, even in famine-like conditions, you can have a life of joy. And it's not joy after suffering. Suffer for a bit, and it'll break through, and then joy will come after sorrow. It's not that. It's not what he says. But during suffering. During suffering. It's not joy replacing sorrow, right? Where you don't have sorrow, you just have joy. It's joy in sorrow, joy during sorrow. You still have sorrow, but you also have joy. And this is important because it's not bottle it up, no sorrow, no pain, just joy. Just smile, right? But a deep, significant, meaningful joy in the Lord, even during your sorrow. It's both. You have sorrow, sorrow that is outmatched and eclipsed by joy in the Lord. And Habakkuk models and calls us to a joy that's not dependent on our circumstances, but is dependent on God. And this is the key. This is so crucial. I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. My joy will not be in my fluctuating circumstances. It will not be in the fragility of my wealth or my security or my image or my status. My joy will be in the Lord who does not change, who does not change. This is amazing because Habakkuk reminds us, we've been talking about how there's good days and evil days. And the world that we live in, the culture, the air that we breathe tells us that joy is dependent on good days, right? Joy, where does joy come from? Joy comes from sunshine and vacations and cars and good relationships and success and early retirement and good food. That's where we get joy. We pursue the joyful life in the things that we consume and the things that we have in our situation. So summer is a time of joy and winter is the time of despair, right? We feel that way. And that's the air that we breathe. It tells us that joy comes from our situation. But Habakkuk says no, because we can be in famine, and I'm going to rejoice in the Lord. For the Christian, joy is not dependent on good days, but on the goodness of God. We derive our joy not from the having of things, but from who God is. God is my joy in good days and in evil days. See, because I think we're operating with a very different sense of what joy is. Our culture is, right? Because the Bible frequently tells us to rejoice, even commands us to rejoice, so that the Apostle Paul can say, rejoice. That's an imperative. That's a command. Rejoice in the Lord. Again, I say rejoice. He's commanding us. How do you command an emotion? You can't, really. And so we recognize that, you know, maybe joy is not a feeling that emerges out of sunshine and going to the beach, but is actually a discipline that we choose or a posture we adopt. To rejoice is to treasure, to value, to find meaning and significance in something. What we rejoice in, we build our identity on. We pursue, we esteem, we honor. And so the heart will always look to rejoice in something, right? There is something that we're deriving joy and worth and value and significance from. Something beyond ourselves, right? We were made for joy. We were made for joy. This is a huge theme in the writings of C.S. Lewis. We're made for joy, and we look for it constantly. And the Christian life does not try to prevent joy or to squash that desire, but actually says we were made for joy, and we are called to satisfy that joy in God himself. That God is the desire that we were made for. And so we pursue that hunger for joy and try and pursue, you know, sunny days and good food and vacations and early retirement and wealth and significance, career success. Those are all just trying to find that the joy that God made us for himself. And we're trying to find it in other places. And so if your joy is in God himself, that's where you find your value and your significance, and that's the thing you're pursuing and loving, it can never be taken away. Now, you can enjoy other things as well, but your driving joy, the joy behind the other joys, the thing that really makes you rejoice, needs to be God himself. And if it is, you will find that you are able to rejoice even at the loss of all things. And it can never be taken away. That is a joy that cannot be crushed by your circumstances. And I'm sure that's the joy that Alan Gardner had. So when all his prayers go unanswered, and all his food runs out, and all his friends die, and he dies of hunger and starvation, his final words can be, and final thoughts can be on the goodness of God. There is a joy that is not dependent on circumstances, but on the unchanging character of who God is. So will you rejoice in the Lord? But suppose you lost your job and your income. Could you rejoice then? Suppose you then defaulted on your mortgage and lost your house too. Can you sing of God's goodness when you don't own a home? Suppose you lost your loved ones. Would God be enough for you? Would his joy sustain you if you grieved the loss of your children or your spouse? Suppose you lost your health and suddenly learned you only had weeks or months to live. Suppose you lost your future. Could you rejoice in the Lord then? Habakkuk is facing the loss of all things, yet he resolves to rejoice in the Lord, even in the midst of pain and tragedy and darkness and evil days. Habakkuk can still rejoice because his joy is not built on the having of things, but on the goodness and salvation of God. See, suffering will always change you. I'm convinced of this. It always does. It will either make you more humble or it will make you more arrogant. It will either make you more sweet or it'll make you bitter and hardened. It'll either strengthen you so that you can do and face anything, or it will make you more fragile and broken and weak. It will either make you grow to new heights, new depth of character, new levels of godliness and maturity, or it will make you crumble. And for those whose joy is in the Lord, suffering can make them grow strong and build their character and bring new levels of humility and drive them even more and more into the arms of God and to know his goodness more and more. See, here's the irony. I think that those of us who don't suffer, but we have a lot of stuff, we tend to not really believe in the goodness of God the way like Alan Gardner was talking about it. And yet, just from testimonies, not personal, but from testimonies, it seems that those who have suffered the most seem to know God's goodness in a way that those of us surrounded by things, just we don't experience it. So there's something about the losing of things which drives us into the goodness of God and to rejoice. I think of Horatio Spafford. You know that name? Hymn writer? His wife and four daughters were traveling to Europe from America in 1873, and he had to follow a few days later on a different ship. And as his wife and four daughters were traveling across the ocean, their ship actually was hit by another ship. I don't know how you do that in the middle of a big ocean, but his ship, their ship, crashed and sunk. And many people died, including all four of his children, but his wife survived. And there he is back in America, and he receives word. He receives like a telegram or something saying that everyone died. She alone survived. And so he goes to meet his wife in Europe. He gets on the ship a few days later. And it's while he's traveling across the ocean, over the same waters, he pens those famous words. Whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well. It is well with my soul. I mean, can you imagine saying those words after the death of your four children? What experience of the goodness of God, what depth of character must you have to be able to go and say, I'm okay, and God is good, even in the midst of the terrible loss. How is that possible? I think we see it in verse 19. It's possible because God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. God, the Lord, is my... Where do you find that within yourself to walk in joy on hard days? You need an unbelievable kind of strength, don't you? Well, we find it. The Lord is my strength. In other places, the word strength gets translated army. And so, you know, while the Babylonians trust in its army, chapter 1, verse 11, whose might is their God, right? The Babylonians, their strength is in their swords and their horses and their soldiers. But Habakkuk has an army as well. And his army, his strength is the Lord himself. Where's your army, Habakkuk? It's God. God is my army. God is my strength. That's who I trust in. Where do you find your strength to keep going? For the Christian, it's in God himself. We don't look to ourselves. our abilities, our wealth, our security, our possessions, our skills, our track record, our experience, our credentials. Where do you find strength to keep going? It's in God himself. All those other things we discard. It's God that gives me strength to have joy on hard days. And so the strength in the Lord makes your feet like the deer on high places. Verse 19, it's a metaphor for rejoicing in the Lord and finding strength in the Lord. Rejoicing on the Lord is like walking sure-footedly on mountaintops. A mountaintop, we live in an amazing place. There's lots of mountains, lots of places you can hike. Love hiking, love the mountains, but they can be dangerous. And so right in this metaphor, I think the mountains are pointing to the dangerous things in our lives. You can slip and fall and you can kill yourself, right? You're crossing the high mountains, those tricky places, slippery spots. And so we recognize there's risk. And so life can bring us through some hard mountains. And so here I think the metaphor is pointing us to those painful situations, like Habakkuk's about to go through with the Babylonian invasion. And so, but if you rejoice in the Lord, and if you find your strength in him, if he's your strength, not your wealth and all that, but if he is your strength, you're able to walk through those mountains like a deer. The deers don't fall. They're just really good at it. God made them so they can climb those mountains, and you see we fall because we've got big feet and we slip on stuff. We only have two. We don't, you know. So you can walk, though, like a deer through the mountains, never falling, through the hardest of situations, if you rejoice in the Lord and he's your strength. And so through those dangerous spots, you will find strong footing and the ability to stand and not fall. And I think that is how all these people have lived the great history of the great heritage of the Christian faith. We look back at all these people that have done this well. Of Alan Gardner, how did he do it? How did he have strength to embrace the goodness of God as he's dying of hunger and say, you know, I lack nothing? How does he say that? He's walking through the mountains like a deer. You know, how does Horatio Spafford sail through the very waters that took the lives of his children and say, it is well with my soul? He's walking like a deer because he's rejoicing in the Lord, and God has given him the strength to take one step at a time. So Habakkuk is a book for evil days, right? Some of you are living in those days, and the rest of us are going to do that in the future. Habakkuk shows us there's no easy answers. There's no pat answers. There's no simple shortcuts, but there is a pathway. There's no easy answers, but there is a way to go. There is a pathway that's laid out for us. And what we've learned from Habakkuk's example is there's a pathway, and it goes like this. There's lament, right? There's honest and faithful wrestling in prayer with God, bringing our hurt, speaking our hurt to him. We don't bottle it up. We don't take it out on God. We don't blog about it. We take it to the Lord in prayer. We wrestle with God, honestly, bringing our pain and speaking it to him. And that's followed by we wait on the Lord. We seek him. We put ourselves in the way of God's community and God's grace and God's word, and we sing and we gather. We don't run from God and his people. We run to them. We wait on the Lord. We seek him. Thirdly, we trust. Hard as it may be, we bring ourselves to a place of trusting in his sovereign plan, even if it makes no sense and it's the exact opposite of what we would like to see happen. We have to come to a place where we trust. The righteous will live by his faith. And finally, we must choose to rejoice even on hard days. And in so doing, we will find strength to walk through the mountains. By choosing to place our joy not in the having of things, but in the goodness of God, we will find the strength that we need to walk through whatever comes. Lament, wait, trust, rejoice. Lament, wait, trust, rejoice. It's not easy. Life is not easy, but there is a pathway. It's not a short path. Could be a long and difficult one, but there's a pathway laid out for us. Lament, wait, trust, rejoice.